Hello, and welcome to 6 Degrees from the City, a podcast about writing and Western Sydney. I'm your host, Fiona Wright, and I'm delighted to be talking in this episode to the travel writer and scholar Walter Mason. Walter's quirky and witty travel memoirs are Destination Saigon and Destination Cambodia, both published by Allen and Unwin, and he facilitates workshops and author talks in libraries and writers' centres all across Sydney. Walter lives and writes in Cabramatta, and I joined him in his home to talk about writing about different places, spirituality, and why someone needs to make The Real Housewives of Cabramatta right away. Here's Walter reading from Destination Saigon and Destination Cambodia.
This is about my friend Chin Pa, who is one of Cambodia's most popular writers. He's very proud to be in the book, by the way. One of his passions is to take cruises along the river, and so I agreed to come along, thinking it would be some kind of floating restaurant that serves the tourist crowd. But Champal's affairs were altogether different. I loved the whole ritual of it, and the haphazard collection of friends, interesting people, artists, musicians, and sometimes feuding lovers who would inevitably turn up. We would gather at one corner of the old market where a woman had an incredibly popular stall that sold a large variety of Chinese desserts. This was how our meals would always start, on land with a selection of brightly coloured and teeth-jarringly sweet desserts topped with warm coconut milk. Normally at the dessert stall there was not a seat to be had, especially not as our group expanded, and I frequently had to stand up to eat mine. I discovered things I had no idea were delicious. Boiled winter melon served with crushed ice and drizzled with condensed milk. Sweet, sticky rice and black beans. Sugary dumplings filled with sesame paste. As the various drifters, bohemians and ne'er-do-wells turned up, the conversation would become increasingly raucous and any pretense at maintaining English was given up. I cursed myself for not learning to speak Khmer, as I promised myself I would. Why hadn't I applied myself over the previous year, when I had known that I would be coming to Cambodia for an extended period? We purchased our meal from the old market. Surprisingly delicious banquets pieced together from whatever street food sellers were hanging about. Sticky rice, thick chunks of dried fish, grilled chicken, and mysterious barbecued meatballs that no one could vouch for with a staple. The stalls were really outdoor buffets, and everything was served to us in slender plastic bags with bamboo chopsticks wrapped at the top in a dangerously complicated manner. While all my friends could elegantly untwist them and begin eating, I engaged in a dangerous and filthy battle which I always lost, my front splashed with Chinese sausages, little dried and barbecued white bait, and two different types of pickled cumber. The Kuan Yin Temple in Yolen, though ostensibly dedicated to the Buddhist goddess, is in fact still a repository for dozens of different deities and spirits. So many, in fact, that staff at the shrine have a hard time identifying some of them. It is situated down the romantically named Laozi Street, within walking distance of several other temples, as well as a porno theatre, a gay sauna, and several hundred brothels. You've got to love Yolen. I visited the Kuan Yin Temple as often as I could, primarily because of the special connection I feel to the Bodhisattva herself, but also because I befriended the temple assistants and other workers there, and they would hide me away in some quiet corner and feed me buns that had been offered to the statues by the faithful. I wasn't quite sure about the etiquette of eating such sacred food, but I figured that they were the experts and wouldn't have offered if it wasn't perfectly acceptable. People came to the temple for all kinds of reasons, because they were praying for something special in their lives, because it was a date of some particular significance to them, and also to memorialise their ancestors. For this purpose, enormous red coils of incense were purchased at the temple office to be suspended from the ceiling in the main hall. These coils burn for days or weeks at a time, a little red rice paper tag dangling down from the middle of them bearing the name of the family or individual in Chinese characters. On festival days, the incense is so plentiful that staff need to wear gas masks and goggles in order to continue their duties. I was always faintly self-conscious when making my way around the shrines with my bundle of smoking incense. Sometimes I drew stares, and sometimes people would follow me around, figuring maybe that wherever I paused to offer incense would be a lucky spot. People in Vietnam are often looking for a luck angle, and an obviously prosperous foreigner is bound to be a good lead. If I wore a shirt with numbers on it, for example, the people in my neighbourhood would buy a lottery ticket containing those same numbers. Or if I came home in a taxi, someone would dash out and jot down the number plate, not for reasons of guaranteeing my safety, which, in my vanity, I initially thought, but in order to use the number as another lottery guide. I became used to being everyone's personal augury.
I really love that piece. I was just sort of thinking as you were reading it that there's kind of two things going on there that I think happen a lot in the book, where you've got that combination of both, you know, having these close friendships, but also very clearly being an outsider and feeling as such and being treated as such, but also that combination of the sacred and the profane. You've got, you know, with the temple just down the roads from the gay bars and the brothels. I think it's a really interesting balance that goes on.
Yes, welcome to my life. I'm never quite sure where the balance lies.
But I was wondering if that's kind of the... if part of that idea about sort of being inside a place and outside a place is the appeal of travel writing in a way.
I think absolutely, yeah. I think that travel writers themselves are almost always strange people, outsiders in some way, you know. And I grew up being inside, outside, you know. I grew up in a tiny place and yet being different from everyone else. So I've always been conscious of never belonging. So for me, travel is just an extension of my childhood and my life. But yeah, I think that's what it is. I think that when we travel, it's almost on some level an unsatisfying experience because we want to understand that place, but we just stick out like crazy.
Yeah.
And our experience of that is never what we hoped it would be. It's never authentic, as everyone wants it to be. But I think we go to a place for 2 weeks completely at sea, not knowing what's going on, but we read books then to sort of help us settle into a place. And I find my relationship with other places that I don't write about is like that. I might visit, and then I'll come home and read a book and understand more, and then I'll go back understanding more and come home and read another book. It's that sort of sifting process of understanding. Mm-hmm. And I can never quite believe how ignorant I was the first time I went.
That's so interesting. I was speaking to another writer a few weeks ago talking about upcoming travels, and she was saying that, you know, before she goes anywhere, she always reads a whole bunch of novels either set in or from that country. And it, you know, made my little heart glad because, you know, I do that too. I don't read any of the travel guides or anything like that, but I read the country's literature. And I sort of feel like it's such an interesting way to get into a place, but you do it on the way back.
Oh, no, I do it before I go too, but for some reason I'm just never quite prepared, you know.
Yeah.
And then when I come back and read something, I think, oh my goodness, how could I not have gone there? How could I possibly have missed that? So
yeah, right.
Yeah, I kind of enjoy that thrill. It's why I keep going back to places rather than going to new places.
Yeah.
I'm trying to force myself.
So you've got a really long relationship with Vietnam, don't you?
Yes, I first went there in 1994.
Wow.
My partner's Vietnamese. I mean, we've been together for 28 years, so it's been a big part of my life. So I go back there every year, and I mean, way more than him. He never goes back. And I think last time we went back was 6 years. So, and it gets to the stage where if people want to something sent to Vietnam, they come over here and drop it off, you know, knowing I'll be there sooner or later. But yeah, that's a very long and complex relationship. I guess my involvement with Vietnam now has been longer than my involvement with my hometown and sort of in my life in North Queensland where I came from.
Wow.
You know, so that's something that I always have to balance out, because my partner Tung Ngo, he says that when we fly back to Townsville, for example, he finds that way more foreign than us flying into Bangkok, for example.
Yeah, right. Townsville. Well, you know, it is an interesting place.
It is, and the culture is so different from Sydney. You know, it really is quite a foreign place. You know, I think that Sydney people do blend in much more comfortably in somewhere like Ho Chi Minh City or Hong Kong than they would in Townsville.
Well, how old were you when you came to Sydney from?
I was 17. So,
oh my God, you were a baby.
Baby, like school. We had to be at school till 1:30 to get our certificate, our leaving certificate. And I think the train left at 2:30, and I was on it. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. Couldn't wait to get away.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, like, I was bitter about it for many years, but now, you know, I guess it always happens, nostalgia and sort of an affection for the place. And when I go back, I find it quite fascinating. And I love how people treat you when you go back. Like, I was in a line at a cafe. I hadn't been to that cafe for 20 years. And the woman behind the counter is quite a lion, and she just looked up and said to me, "Won't be a minute, Walter." Like... like I've been there yesterday. I just was like, wow, nothing changes.
Yeah, wow. And did you come straight to Western Sydney, or did you live elsewhere?
No. What kind of inner west? You know, I went. Yeah. I had a friend living. My only contact was in Erskineville.
Okay.
So I lived in Erskineville. Yeah, and then I sort of lived around the inner city. But I met my partner Tang quite young, and he was from Cabramatta, from here. And we sort of hung out near the city for a couple of years, but eventually he was on the local council here in Fairfield, and we moved back here. And it's subsequently become much more important to my lifestyle to live here than to live in the inner city.
Mm. Why is that, do you think?
It has a similar energy for a start, you know. There's always something going on. If, you know, when I go into Cabramatta for lunch every day, it's like, bam, you know, it's on, people running everywhere. It just feeds my lifestyle. It's close to temple. I just, all the things that I want and need are here. And, you know, I'm an inveterate train traveller, so I'm always on the train going somewhere else, so it doesn't hold me back in any way.
That's interesting. I was talking to Lachlan Brown very early on, and, you know, a lot of his poems are set on trains. and we were talking about kind of, you know, growing up in the West, the train being this kind of...
Yeah.
You know, motif both of, like, going to other places, but also of the place where you sit and read.
Yes, yeah. It's a sort of repository of wisdom.
Yeah,
The train's interesting because my nephew in Vietnam, he's done really, really well in business, you know, he finally came over here on a holiday a couple of years ago, and so I just took him everywhere on the train. And he'd never really been on the train before, and he was just amazed, and he loved it. And now he asks me to send him pictures of the train when he's away. He just thinks it's this... For him, it's Sydney, getting on the train,
wow,
going somewhere.
That's really great.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like for people who kind of grow up or live out here, the train is such an integral part of how you understand the city and
absolutely
how you live about in it.
Yeah. And Max, I remember once, a couple of years ago, I was on the train, and there was some... There's some sort of thing happened and all the trains stopped. And I was at Merrylands and I'd never been out of the train at Merrylands before. And so I got out and I walked around and it's such a fantastic place. And now we go there all the time and I think, wow, I'm just travelling through all these places. And
it's
I really
a weird
stopped.
Place, Merrylands.
Yeah, it is.
I always feel like it's very ironically named.
Yes. Yeah. It's great food there, by the way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and there's a big W, which is good. It's got everything.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, your books are very personal, which obviously is something I'm really interested in. And if you see a sort of overlap between memoir and travel writing, or if you see them as two sort of, as kind of distinct things more generally that you're bringing together.
Not really. No, I think they're totally, totally linked in with one another. I think that there is an older style of travel writing, which was an account of the journey.
Yeah.
Which I think people aren't all that interested in anymore, because I think we're all familiar with the mechanics of travel. I think that was for another day.
A day where people most likely weren't going to get to experience that place themselves.
Exactly right, yeah. So it was interesting for them.
6 weeks by boat.
Yeah. So, but definitely it's just intimate. I couldn't have written that sort of book anyhow. I just wanted to write about all the things. I always say I write the things that I tell people when I get drunk at a dinner party. So that's what it is. Like, I had to get these stories off my chest, you know, and then worry about them later, of course.
I like that because I have a friend now who will tell me stories at pubs or dinner parties and then say to me, "You're not going to write that one down." Don't turn that into one of your stories.
Absolutely. I've got a dear friend in Cambodia, Sul Mak. He is a very well-known novelist in Cambodia. He wrote Cambodia's first gay novel.
He's a great
writer and a great friend, and I would tell him all these outrageous stories, and he always says, "One day you're going to have to write the real stories." You know, have to not censor yourself, but it might have to be after I die.
Right. I do like the way, though, one of the things I really love about the books is that they have that sort of sense of personality and anecdote to them. I think that lends you a kind of intimate tone, like you were talking to someone.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I do intentionally set out to recreate my own voice when I write. It's something that I absolutely try to do. And I notice that when things get dull, it's because I'm not trying to do that, you know. So I think I have a distinct style of talking, a distinct style of telling a story, and I want to get that through in my writing as well, because it can be satisfying, but it can also be sort of overbearing as well, so I have to watch that, you know. I think it's something I've never had to struggle with, you know.
Yeah.
So, in fact, quite the opposite. So when I've had to do copywriting, when I've had to write in a corporate situation, I would often get things sent back to me saying, you know, way too much personality. cut it back. I used to have to write catalogues.
Oh, wow.
And catalogues for books. And, you know, like you're writing a 50-word description of a book you've never read, and you're writing dozens in a day. And my boss always said he could tell when I was getting tired because each book became fabulous. You know? So he used to stop me at a certain time in the day.
The authors would probably love that, though, right?
Surely. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
It's interesting. I know a lot of people who do copywriting on the side, and I've always wondered that, how you'd manage the two voices.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but I think the best copywriting does have a voice in it, you know, it does have a sort of a slight naughtiness that sneaks through. Yeah. But I don't know, I've never, like, written for computer manuals or anything, so I don't know how I'd go.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Naughtiness is a good word, though. You're sort of talking before about how the books are quite naughty.
Yeah, there's an element of naughtiness there. I think, quite unintentionally, though, I think I found my level. I realised who my readers are, and they want to be titillated, but not too much. You
right.
know? So I only go so far. But yeah, like, I mean, that's just a part of me. Like, I have these two bizarre sides of my personality. I have this reverent, devotional side. You know, I'm forever praying and doing things like that. And also this sort of real naughty side, which got me into lots of trouble as a child and continues to get me into trouble. But I think is what, I don't know, if you believe in astrology, I'm a Scorpio.
Oh, me too.
Oh, well, here we go. And, you know, they always say Scorpios make the best monks and nuns because, you know, they like to do things with passion.
Right. So. I thought you were going to say, like, to extremes.
Yeah, to extremes, yeah.
You know, because the aesthetic
part
of me, you know, the part of me that allows me to not eat for days on end.
Yeah. Have you ever been called to monastic life?
No.
No?
No, I don't like the outfits.
They're so forgiving, that is. But yeah, so I always tell my partner, like, if he ever dies, I don't think I'd bother again. I think I'd just enter into a monastic community, you know. So I've done that part, so maybe.
Yeah, you spent time on the monastic
trail. Yeah, I spent lots of times in monasteries, yeah.
Yeah.
Enough to make me realise I couldn't spend forever there, you know, not at that stage of my life anyhow. I remember I was in a monastery in Thailand for 3 months, and for the first sort of month and a half I was really, really good, like, you know, number one student, you know, meditator, pure, the holiness shone out of me. And then in the next sort of, after a month and a half, this university soccer team arrived as some sort of exercise, and, like, of course this lust arose in me. I found myself washing their t-shirts and
whoops.
Yeah, I realized I hadn't quite become enlightened. Yeah.
Defended myself of earthly concerns.
That's right, all those earthly concerns. But so I think that's, it's good to have those things, though, you know. I think the people who, I mean, there are people who are holy, you know, there are people who don't notice those things, and I really love those people and would like to be one of them. I just can't be.
Yeah, I, you know, I'm really interested in that, all of that part there, because I think it's so important to your writing.
Yes.
But it also makes me think, I remember one of the first talks I ever saw you give was while you're doing your PhD at Western Sydney University. And,
yes.
And it was about the history of self-help books, because I know that's what you were looking at, and the way they'd adopted Eastern tradition as kind of a guide to Western self-improvement,
yeah,
I guess. And it was the funniest academic paper I've ever been.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I've ever been a part of. But, but I found it fascinating too, because it's not something that I've had much contact with.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it is. I think it's interesting. It's good to... That's why I think it's good to have sort of competing interests, because you can sometimes create something interesting out of them. You know, sort of pop this with this and, wow, that's interesting. My partner and I watch a lot of reality television, and we've discovered a new one which combines, like, sort of a show called Ex on the Beach, which is where people have to meet their spend like a week in a holiday resort with their ex.
Oh my god!
With like The Greatest Loser. So now it's sort of chubby people on the beach, like, with their exes. We thought, this is superb. I can say that because I'm quite chubby, listeners. But we thought, what a superb meeting of cultures here. This can keep going forever, you know.
Wow.
Throw in two different ideas.
This is kind of a tangent, but I've always wanted to make a reality TV show that's a combination of MasterChef and Survivor.
Oh, there you go.
And, of course, this comes from my own interest and experience, where everybody who's competing has, you know, a food allergy or intolerance that the others don't know about, and they cook each other meals, and whoever doesn't die is the one who wins.
This is what we've been doing, pitching this. I work for
I'd get knocked out in the first round, easy, but...
I worked for years at a New Age bookshop, and we had this list of the most arcane subcategories for books. You know, you wouldn't believe it was an incredible list. It was hundreds of subcategories. So if someone came in and said, "I want a book on this," you know, which wouldn't be in the title, we'd be able to search for it. And before I left, I printed out this list of subcategories because I said, for the rest of my life, I'm going to cut them up and just put them in a bag. And whenever I want to write a book, I'm just going to pull out two of them by chance and combine them. And I still think I should do that.
Or just make a really long found poem.
Yeah, that's true. That'd be brilliant.
But that must have been fascinating.
It was brilliant. It was so much fun. And sadly, that store's closed. When it closed, it was called Adyar Bookshop, and it was the oldest independent bookshop in the country when it closed. It was really sad. And the people who worked there not only were freaks in the best sense, everyone was insane, but also everyone was brilliant. And I often think how much collective knowledge was lost when we were sort of cut up and sent out into the world, because you could come in and ask us the most obscure question and there would be someone there who could answer every time.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. So I think bookshops are always like this, though, aren't they? They're often filled with people who know so much and who probably should be earning a lot more money somewhere else.
Yeah, that's so interesting. But, you know, I did want to ask you about that link between self-help books and the kind of Eastern spirituality stuff that...
Yeah.
Basically, what did you discover in your 3 years of research?
Yeah, look, well, they fit in so well. You know, they do fit in so well. There's a reason why they were adopted. And also the other way as well. I gave a workshop on spiritual journal writing last year at a Hindu nunnery. And it was lots of fun. We had a great time, and you know, lay people came as well. And one of the guys, you know, a devout, lifelong Hindu, was telling me at lunch about all these wonderfully sort of Edwardian self-help books that they'd all read as children in India, you know, and how that absolutely transformed his life. You know, things we laugh at now, but you know, but they're books I also quite respect. You know, they're sort of the real classics of the genre that no one reads anymore. You know, and he said they'd been recommended by swamis, by monks. You know, read Frederick Bales or read William Walter Atkinson and all these other people. You know, and he said, you know, they had real currency then because they're all about controlling the mind and redirecting thoughts and all those classic things. So there is a place there, and people might say it shouldn't happen, but it's always going to happen. You can't stop the sort of melding of traditions. And I love going into the self-help section when I'm in other countries as well. You know, it's so fascinating to see what people in Vietnam are reading, to see what people in Cambodia are reading when it comes to that, you know. It's great. There's a big market, for example, for Louise Hay books. In Vietnam, they're all translated, and all of the affirmations are on a CD in Vietnamese that you can sort of listen to. So it was really interesting to see that happen. Mm.
And I was thinking too, I know you did a workshop recently too on mindfulness and writing.
That was a
fascinating combination.
I teach a course quite regularly on that subject. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I think people are really interested in that, and sort of a meditative approach to writing. I mean, writing generally is quite meditative anyhow. I think it's something that involves real intention. We have to slow down just to be able to type or to write using a pen. You know, it's a very slow process. I mean, people have managed to do it in unmindful ways. You know, I think of Tennessee Williams with his bottle of pills on the desk, or Carson McCullers, the wonderful Carson McCullers. She would have her special writing tea. It was a pot of tea, which was 40% tea, and the rest was rum, and that's what she'd have writing in the morning, which explains some of her wonderful short stories. Yeah, first thing in the morning. Yeah. So that's a less mindful way to do it. Heavens, Carson McCullers is one of my favourite writers, so it worked.
Yeah. I was wondering, too, if it sort of plays into that idea of attending to detail and to strange and telling things, if that's kind of a mindful practice.
It is, and noticing smallness, noticing incident where other people don't. I think that's what writers excel in. A writer can walk into a room and pick out several strange things which other people might have just sort of glanced over or thought not important.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've had the same experience, but I was doing that as a child, a small child. You know, I'd notice something odd and I'd get into the car later and mention it to my parents.
And then your parents would be like, huh.
What was that? Yeah. So I think, yeah, there's that element and I encourage that with people. I think it's a real way to move ahead. The way into something, the way into a story is always through that tiny little detail, isn't it? That sort of small thing.
From poetry background, you're speaking my language here.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of, I don't know, I hate and also bad at that big picture thing, you know. Mm. It doesn't interest me really and, you know, I find it dull to read. So when I had to write, for example, in Destination Cambodia about Angkor Wat, you know, the ancient temple, which has been written about 7 million times in 100 different features a month. You know, like, how do I write about that and not be cliched? So I always had to look for a way in. And it's terrifying when you do have to write about something that's sort of so cliched. But you have to sometimes.
I imagine, too, when you have to give context for parts of the book, how you sort of step out and do that kind of historical stuff, especially with the Cambodia book. That so many of these places are so specific because of...
That's right,
great and mostly awful things that have happened there.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I find that in all of it. And I didn't set out to do it this way, but a lot of my readers have come back to me and said, I learn more about the history and the culture of the place through reading your crazy stories than I did through reading, you know, like a proper book about the subject, because I just stuck in my mind, you know. And then when I was there, it seemed so real, and I remembered what you said. And I think that's what I unintentionally have done, sort of. And maybe that's the way they should be writing history books for school, you know. Maybe someone should hire me to do that, because, these things stick with you.
But I wonder if part of that, too, is because so many of the interactions that you have are behind the scenes things. Like for the section that you read about the Kuan Yin Temple, you're not talking about being in the temple as someone kind of, you know, sitting in the spaces that you're allowed to go and looking at the things that you're allowed to do. You're talking about, you know, wearing a gas mask and eating the goddess's offerings with the monks. There's a sort of an unofficialness to it, or a backstageness.
Yeah. That's interesting, backstage, because my background is in acting. When I first left school, I went to theatre school. I went to... I went to do a degree in theatre. I soon pulled out because I realised I was never going to be a star. But yeah, I think I have always loved the idea of a back and a front to something. Mm. And everything has it, you know. I take it as a personal challenge. When I walk into a place, I always think, how can I get behind the scenes? You know, the sort of... And I do it sort of... quite ruthlessly, I am. And that particular, in the Jolan Temple, which I've been going to, you know, since I was 24 years old, and I'm substantially older now, but I remember cracking that place. I remember it fascinated me, and I just went back day after day after day and sat in the same chair, which was sort of hidden in a corner. And really, after about the fourth or fifth day, people are so curious as to what the hell you're doing that they'll take an interest in you. So I always tell people that. I said, just keep going back to places, and after a while, people are really interested in you, and that opens up everything. And one of the boys in that book, he was a boy when I first met him. He was 16. Now he's married with kids. He's kind of middle aged, and I just got a message from him the other day, and I've been part of his life all of that time, and I think that's such a blessing to be able to have that experience. When I was 15 years old, sitting in high school in Ingham, North Queensland, I didn't think that I would know anyone that interesting or do anything that interesting. You know, my life seemingly was going to be like a small town hairdresser and, you know, and maybe, I don't know, an occasional trip to Daydream Island. But look what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that fascinates me, that kind of thing, how you can never really have a sense of the shape of these things is what we make afterwards and figure out how those sorts of things kind of come. But I think kind of, I wonder if it's a writerly impulse, but I'm always trying to kind of figure out what's happening and all the whole time knowing that you just can't know, right?
Like, and it is kind of harder now too with security situations and all those things. It is a little bit harder to get behind the scenes. Mm. I went to see my friend Denise Scott the other night at the Opera House, and I was very excited because the first time ever I went behind the scenes. I was so thrilled. I really felt like I made it, you know.
It's it's quite ugly behind the scenes.
It is, yes, it's very industrial.
I got taken back there for an event that I did once and sort of went the back way into the green room.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, you know, the phrase I use, like the bowels of a building, I really felt like I was in the bowels.
Absolutely.
Because there was all this piping and...
Yeah, exposed.
Long dark corridors. Yeah.
Exposed concrete and things, yeah.
Not to get, you know, too disgusting about things. The other thing that I was really interested in those pieces that you read is that sense of friendship that comes up, that it seems like the relationships are one of the really important things in the book, and I guess that ties into what you were...
Yeah. I think I'm quite an emotionally needy person, I think, so that's just a response to that. I find it very difficult to be alone. I can be alone at home, you know, but, you know, sort of after a while, it doesn't do me any good, and I just find that I need to make contacts with people, and so I do that. I have friends who are much better at it than me, but, you know, I still think I have a reasonable genius at sort of making a contact with someone. If you're absolutely desperate, just keep going back to the same cafe day after day, and after a while, the waiters and waitresses will be your best friends, you know, so, I like to meet new people and to understand what they're doing. And I write about it in Destination Cambodia. I write about coming at something as an expert and as opposed to actually stopping and listening to what people are saying about something, because you might very well be right. So I'm, you know, when I came, I'd been going to Cambodia for years. I'd read every book about Angkor Wat. I knew all about that Angkorian period. I teach it, you know.
Yeah.
And then my friends in Cambodia would say something which was just wrong, you know, just historically inaccurate, and I would just correct them, you know. I must have been excited. And then I thought, hang on, this is really interesting what they're saying to me. Like, what they're telling me is what is important, the story that's important to them about Angkor. And when I stopped correcting and started to listen to their stories, it was way more fun and interesting, you know. So that's something I've tried to carry into my life since then. Mm. And then that's a lesson learned at age 41, you know. So we're always learning something new.
I was going to ask you about that, because I noticed, you know, a lot of the bios I've seen for you online, you describe yourself as a lifelong dilettante.
Yes.
And it struck me as a really interesting phrase. Is that sort of the thing that you mean? Or?
Absolutely, yeah. Like I've led a supremely wasted life, you know. I, you know, picked up lots of little things and never really mastered anything. And if my academic supervisor is listening, you know, my thesis is finished. I think it is a fault in a way to be so curious and to give into that curiosity always. But it does make your world much more interesting, you know. But I do. Envy those people who can concentrate on one thing and just become geniuses at it. I've never been able to.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it struck me as a really interesting phrase because, and it's a problem with my own baggage, I get really prickly about the expertise of being a writer, right?
Yes, like, yes.
Years ago I had a friend who's a scientist and, you know, has a PhD in science.
Yeah.
Talk about... He's, you know, telling me about how he was thinking about, you know, when he gets his long service leave, taking, you know, 6 months off and writing a book because he's got a book in me. And I kind of had that instinctive reaction of, you can't do that. I mean, you could, but, like, you've just devalued, you know, all of this work and expertise that I've built up. And, oh, I might take 6 months off and do the science thing. You know, the Margaret Atwood response.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think I had this instinctive kind of,
yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's such an interesting phrase. Yeah. But when you talk about it in that sense of eternal curiosity, then...
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, people do it.
I know.
I do really well out of it too. And I think it's sort of a Western malaise as well to really want to be something and to stand up and be that thing forever.
Mm.
I see it in sexuality, you know, like I think the rest of the world has a much more of a sliding scale when it comes to sexuality than we do here. It seems to me that in Australia, if you do something once, you better stick with it. Whereas I know people
who
do something a lot and yet don't sort of see themselves as that thing, you know, and It happens in our spiritual lives too. We don't really respect people who sort of slip around. But in Asia, people in Vietnam, people do that a lot. And, you know, people might go to see a spiritualist medium for one thing, and then they'll go to a monk for another thing, and then they'll sneak in to the Catholic Church and say a prayer to Mary for something else. Yeah. You know, all these things are expedient. And I have a very dear friend, I think I mentioned briefly in Destination Saigon, but he's been a friend of mine for 25 years. And it's funny because I knew him as a student monk when he's a little bit naughty, and now he's this revered abbot in a small town in Vietnam, right. And he's very respectable, you know, and it's lovely to see that journey. And But I remember after knowing him for like 10 years, and we'd done everything together. We'd sort of prayed together and done retreats together and driven around on motorcycles together. And he said to me, "Oh, what's your religion? Do you have a religion?" And I thought, wow, after 10 years, someone whose life is religion, he's just asking me now, because it wasn't important to him. What was important was, I guess, how I was living and the relationship that we were having. And that really woke me up, because I think if you set foot in a sort of, a Baptist church on a Sunday, you're going to be asked pretty quickly, where do you stand on this?
Yeah.
Have you signed up? You know? So, and I think that's, I don't want to say failing, because I don't call anyone's spiritual journey a failing, but I do think it's a highly restrictive thing where people are curious, but they're too afraid to sort of venture into that curiosity because they're scared someone will leap on them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's such a lovely way of thinking about it. Well, I think curiosity is a really important trait and a really important writerly trait too, right?
Yeah.
Like
that
kind of always sort of poking at things.
Yes, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and writing things that are different. I mean, look at you, you're the expert in this. Writing something that's completely off career,
That was an accident. It doesn't count.
And you know, the publishers don't want you to do that, of course. They want you to be a brand and a product, which I perfectly understand. Like, I'm not against that. I understand that's how the modern world works. And my partner's an advertising executive, I do understand. And one much more famous and well-known author than me said to me, "I love how everything that you do is on brand, I'm not doing it intentionally, it is actually my life, But yeah, I mean, you want to do a million things, don't you? And those things that might be strange, and I think you should follow them up, even if they don't quite work out or they never sell,
It's funny, I don't think of you as being on brand, because you do so many talks on such wide and varied topics.
That's true too, yeah. Like in one week I might do a talk on Dickens, lead a workshop on mindfulness and writing, and then teach, a 3-hour class in Cambodian history.
But then also, as a part of that, you seem to do so many talks that are about supporting other writers too, and bringing them into things. And I think that's a really lovely and generous...
Thank you.
Community thing that you do.
Yeah. Well, it's part of what I feel is really important. And I think we're lucky as writers. I think in Australia the writing scene is reasonably supportive. Mm. I don't see a lot of bitchiness. I don't see a lot of jealousy.
You're not a poet.
Maybe if I ventured in. Well, my partner, one of his hobbies is food blogging. And I've got to tell you, the food blogging world is cutthroat. And I don't see that with writers,
That amazes me. I always thought that all the... I guess it...
They're terrifying,
Yeah.
No, it's, for some reason, it's definitely... And I've had friends in the fashion blogging world too who say the same thing. It's very... But also... and you can roll your eyes if you want to, but it's an important part of my spirituality too. My sort of lived spirituality is I do think it's important to more than occasionally put your own needs second and try to think of how you can be useful to other people. I think it does create a community. Mm. I think it does create a better world for everyone. And I think writers need it. I think I always think, be the reader you wish that you had. So if I read something, I always tell people how much I love it. And I send the writer an email or even a letter, and I almost always get a response. I just think it's something that's really easy to do. I think people are always out there searching for ways to change the world, and they underestimate just how much they can change that sort of little world around them in a profound way.
I love that idea of being the reader that you wish you had, because I hear people say all the time, write the thing that you needed to read.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the inversion of that.
That's, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I noticed that when my first book came out, that when I did like a reading or an event, well-known writers that would come to hear me would buy like 2 or 3 copies of my book, even though I know that either my publisher had sent them a free copy or they could have called my publisher and gotten a free copy. But, you know, that was their way of saying, you know, hi, this is me supporting you. And they would have given them away to someone or whatever. But so I always try to do that now too, when I go to a launch or something, and I get a couple of copies and wait in the line to get it signed, you know, because I just know how important that is for the person.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, yeah.
On a different tack, I wanted to ask you about Cabramatta.
Yes, yes.
Specifically.
Yes.
Tell me more about Cabramatta.
Cabramatta. Oh, I love Vietnam first and I love Cabramatta second.
Yep. You know?
But the two are linked very strongly.
Queensland fifth.
Country Queensland fifth. But, so my partner is a Cabra boy and so I first started coming out here in the late 80s when it was a really different place and I just loved it right from the inside. A, it kind of reminded me of home, that close-linked community. Yeah. And my partner says whenever he goes to my family events or something, he goes, they're just like Vietnamese, he said. Everyone's cooking and giving each other food and they all know each other's business, you know. So I think, there is that thing of everyone having so much more in common than they realise. And Cabramatta is just, you know, like it's a cliche, you know. We lead tours sometimes to Cabramatta, so we are responsible for that tourist influx. But we used to do a tour for the Mossman Evening College, and oh so it would God. Be the quintessential Mossman ladies would come out, and they would just have a ball of a time. They couldn't believe how much fun it was, and B, they'd always say, "I'm going to come here again and again because I thought it was dangerous. I thought I wouldn't be able to navigate the place, but it's just fabulous. It's just fun, and that's really what it is. There's so much energy, you know. Just if I need a boost of energy, I can just walk through Cabra. And I always joke to think they should like a Real Housewives of Cabramatta, and I should be one of them. I always feel my partner's going, oh God, this is all you do, isn't it? You just swan around Cabra all day.
I'm a lady who lunches, darling.
That's right. Yeah. So it's sort of a It does feed my creative life in a really strong way. It really does. I'm searching everywhere. You know how you know the best piece you've ever written and you keep losing it? Do you have that?
I dream it.
Oh, you dream it?
Yeah. I dream these genius phrases structural things or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I've got this little pad beside my bed and I sometimes scribble something down and I look at it in the morning and it's either completely illegible,
or
it says something like oranges are orange.
Beautiful. I actually had the experience, it was years before I published, and I went to some festival where I had local writers reading, and I wrote a piece especially for it, and it was a piece about in that stage we were living in townhouse right in Cabra, and so my local temple was a different temple, and the monk there was my age and we were really good friends, but coming with that, it's too much familiarity. So we'd have fights and, you know, and then I'd remind myself that he's a monk. And then, like, you know, he'd like sort of lord it over me sometimes to get me to iron his robes or something, just to sort of say, hang on here, we're not mates. And I wrote this very short piece. It's like a prose poem about my relationship with my master. And it was called My Master. And I read it out and I had people shrieking with laughter and crying at the end. And I thought, this is superb. But for some reason, you know, very changing computers and various things, lost it. And I just had a hard copy of it. And I found it again after all these years. I found it again like about a year ago. And I've lost it again. I wanted to read it for you. So it's haunting me, this piece of genius that I wrote, and it's gone.
You know, you got to scan it when you find it, right?
I know. I'll have to do it this next time. But yeah, I actually had that experience. I'm a journal keeper. I write constantly in my journal. I carry it with me everywhere. And I was in China for a conference, and I was catching the very fast train from Shanghai to Nanjing, and so I was writing in my I'd been writing my journal for days in Shanghai, and I just genius was flowing out, like really the best stuff I've ever done. And I was writing and it just kept flowing at the train station. You know, Shanghai train station is amazing. And the train came and I jumped in, and I was reading the memoirs of Tennessee Williams at the time, and I was reading it and I thought, I've got to jot this down, this is genius. And I realised I'd left my journal at the train station. And to this day, I still remember things that were in it, you know.
Yeah.
The best work I've ever done. It's all sitting there.
It's all somewhere else.
Somewhere else in Shanghai in a bin. So sad, so sad. That's sort of the El Dorado of literary genius.
Yeah. Or, you know, my dad's a fisherman. It's,
yeah.
You know, the ones that got away.
The one that got away. Every time. Yeah. Well, I see that as a teacher of writing. So often students will tell me, you know, I had this really brilliant idea and I told it to someone and then they did it and then, you know, I lost it. And I always think, oh, you're, at least they did it, you know. I mean, that's the thing. These things only come to you for a certain time and you've got to let go of them or let someone else do it.
Yeah.
And they're never original ideas anyway, let's face it. You know, it reminds me of Seinfeld, you know, where he has that book of a coffee table about coffee tables.
And, oh, that's so wonderful.
And then someone does it and he's really angry because he thinks they stole his idea.
I don't think anyone's going to steal Real Housewives of Cabramatta.
You know, I might pitch it to someone.
Although if they do, I think we'd all be very happy.
It'd be such a great show. Yeah. You know, I saw recently that one of the biggest postcodes for millionaires in Australia is 2166, this area.
Really?
Yeah, there's a lot of money out here.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that idea too, that I guess if you've been here from the late 80s, that was probably when Cabramatta was at its most maligned.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, really, and the way that cities change.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, absolutely, Cabramatta is a case study in that, going from a place where people are too terrified to come into being really a tourist destination in Sydney and a much loved place, a place where people bring their visitors it's interesting to note the change. But it's interesting too how the history is always there with it. So Cabramatta, for example, is not a nighttime place because of those bad days where the shopkeepers didn't dare open in the evening. Mm. So it's still like literally only two or three restaurants that will stay open in Cabramatta at night. So it's still very much a daytime place, and come 5:30 it's closed. So
there's
that part. I mean, if they open at nighttime now, they just get people all the time, but they have a certain lifestyle that they're used to and they're happy with that.
Mm. Mm. Interesting to me too. I think you mentioned that your partner does the food blogging, and that must give you a different relationship to the place as well.
Yeah. And also he was on the council for so long, it was about 9 years.
That's a long time.
And a very prominent member of that council. And at the time, the only Vietnamese person on council. So knowing everyone and speaking Vietnamese as well, you know, it's sort of. I do have a tendency to swan, you know. But it is fun being a part of those people's lives. People have so much energy. There's such an entrepreneurial spirit there. People are always thinking about something to do and how to change it. And yet nothing ever seems to change. Knowing faces and people. But everyone's like that in Canberra. Like kids who grew up here, they all know the particular bread shop ladies or, you know, the people who live on the street or someone, you know, who sort of wanders around and does peculiar things. It's one good thing, like, being here, so many young people sort of come to Tung and I as friends and mentors, and they make great house sitters when we go away. These are kids who are born here, you know, and went to school, like, across the road here or over at Canberra High, and they have this wonderful Cabramatta-specific view of the world, you know, and it's... It's quite amazing. Like I feel excited for them.
Yeah,
it's a lot of get up and go there.
I think that's the stuff that I'm really interested in.
Yeah,
with these sort of the Western Sydney writing projects that are, you know, all the different ones that are popping up everywhere. That's something I didn't realise until much later when I left. That you grow up with this kind of specific idea of the city that is actually quite unique.
Yeah.
In its way, and not the main narrative of the city.
Absolutely, And people out here, they can live their lives totally focused around here and have subcultures and things that are you know quite separate from someone in the south or in the north or you know it's quite specific and something. Some of that has to do with ethnicity and language, but a lot of it doesn't as well, or a lot of it has to do with the experience of that shared or that blended ethnicity and language. So One of the subcultures out here is Cambo-Chinese. Like, so kids whose parents are Cambodian-Chinese or Cambodian and Chinese married together.
Yeah.
And they're quite a specific subculture. You know, it's so interesting to see them sort of hang out. And if they get married to a Vietnamese person, it's quite noteworthy.
Right.
So it's interesting. So certain shops are Cambo-Chinese, certain shops are Vietnamese, and to see how those... blend together when their children grow up. So my personal trainer is a Cambo-Chinese boy, and he's just got engaged to a Filipino-Scottish girl.
You know?
So it's sort of a mixing of those subcultures at school.
Thank you, Walter. It's been really lovely.
Pleasure. It's been lovely having you here.
Thank you. Supported by the Crown Packer Foundation, the Sydney Review of Books, and the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University. Our theme music is by Phil Fadul, and production assistance is by Ben Denham. Thank you for listening, and see you again soon.